This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Boston Noir, edited by Dennis Lehane, narrated by Scott Brick, Mark Vitor, Suzanne Torin, Jerry Silverman, Jason Culp, and a full cast. Introduction. Written by Dennis Lehane and narrated by Scott Brick.
Tribalism and knuckleheads. No matter what you may hear to the contrary, noir is not a genre defined by fedoras, silver streams of cigarette smoke, vempy femme fatales, huge white wall tires, mournful jazz playing in the gloomy background, and lots of shadows. Nor is it simply scuzzy people doing scuzzy things to other scuzzy people, a kind of trailer park opera. One could argue that what it is, however, is working-class tragedy. Aristotle, when he defined tragedy, mandated that a tragic hero must fall from a great height. But Aristotle never imagined the kind of roadside motels James M. Cain could conjure up, or saw the smokestacks rise in the northern English industrial hell of Ted Lewis's Get Carter. In Shakespeare, tragic heroes fall from mountaintops. In noir, they fall from curbs. Tragic heroes die in a blaze of their own ill-advised conflation. Noir heroes die clutching fences, or crumpled in trunks, or, in the case of poor Eddie Coyle, they simply doze off drunkenly in a car and take one in the back of the head before they have a chance to wake up again. No wise final words, no music swelling on the soundtrack. Eddie Coyle is a good example here, because if there's a more seminal noir novel of the last 40 years than The Friends of Eddie Coyle, I don't know of it. And more than just being a seminal noir, it's also the quintessential Boston novel. It captures the tribalism of the city, the fatalism of it, and the outsized humor of people who believe God likes a good laugh, usually at your expense. Boston is a city that produces guys, or in the city's vernacular, knuckleheads, who once stole the replica of a cow that sat in front of a Braintree steakhouse. The cow weighed what a car weighed, and yet these knuckleheads had the industry to get it onto a pickup truck, drive it back to South Boston, and deposit it in the middle of Broadway. They did this solely so they could then call the Boston Police Department and ask them to respond to a beef going down on Broadway. In Boston, something doesn't simply hurt, it hurts like a bastard. Pisser is a noun that means something funny. But pissa is an adjective, and sometimes an adverb, that equates unequivocal greatness, although it's often equivocated with wicked, as in, Big Poppy hit a wicked pissa homer against the Yankees. Must have hurt them like a bastard. So we have our distinct humor and our distinct accent and our distinct vocabulary, all of which, sadly, possibly, is now endangered by progress. Because one can't ignore that Boston has been beset by a new class war of late, one you'll see reflected in the stories herein. It's a war of gentrification. As the city continues to lose its old-school parochialism and overt immigrant tribalism, it's also losing a lot of its character. Whether that's a bad thing or a good thing is up for debate, but what can't be argued is that it is, in fact, happening. South Boston is no longer dominated by buzz cuts and bar brawls. These days, Charlestown's only code of silence pertains to failing to tell people about a new restaurant on Warren Street because you don't want to have to start waiting for a table. The Italian tongues of the North End are being phased out by voices questioning why there's no Crate and Barrel beside the Paul Revere house. It's a less violent city now than it ever was, but a beiger one too. I have no doubt the old Boston will rear its head with pride and fury for a long time to come, but I admit to feeling loss when I walk through Kenmore Square these days and see only a kind of soft rock version of what it used to be. That's the paradox of the new Boston. What's lost has in many cases been taken. What's left is what people can't sell. Noir is a genre of loss, of men and women unable to roll with the changing times, so the changing times instead roll over them. Often a noir hero or anti-hero doesn't die from being rolled over, but he might prefer he had. The machine frequently leaves him crushed, attenuated, castrated. No art form that I know of rages against the machine more violently than noir. Hip-hop, arguably, but noir refuses to indulge in hip-hop delusions of grandeur or self-aggrandizement. Noir rages without much hope, certainly without romanticism or wish fulfillment. But Boston gives noir the strain of humor you never expect, which comes at you from directions you could never predict. The guys who placed that stolen cow in the middle of Broadway would fit perfectly in the pages you're about to read. The journey ranges from a pitch-black discourse on sin in John Dufresne's The Cross-Eyed Bear to a haplessly absurd kidnapper in Jim Fusilli's The Place Where He Belongs. From the deliciously strange relationship between a black divorcee and a white escaped convict in Patricia Powell's Dark Waters, to Don Lee's chilling meditation on questions of identity and self in The Oriental Hair Poets, to a carload of knucklehead armed robbers tooling around North Quincy in Russ Ayborn's Turn Speed. And those are just half of the wonderful stories in this collection. One of the recurrent themes of noir has always been the search for home. Not home in the physical sense, though that does happen, but in the irrational emotional sense. The heroes and heroines of noir are usually chasing something they couldn't hold even if they caught up to it. Some part of them understands the futility of this chase, even as another part clings to the need for it. This is probably why, if only to alleviate the pain of waiting, they chase something else in the meantime. A lover, a bank job, the murder of an inconvenient spouse. Yet, the home being searched for in these pages might be Boston, and the journey to find it, however fruitless that goal may turn out to be, is as rich and varied, as hilarious and sad, and ultimately as engaging as the city itself. Dennis Lehane, Boston, Massachusetts, July 2009.
Part 1. Fear and Loathing. Exit Interview. Written by Lynn Heitman and narrated by Karen White. Financial District.
It had been one of those weird, sticky, cool summer days in downtown Boston, the kind that are as hot and humid as they're supposed to be, until the breeze blows in off the water, and all of a sudden it's freezing cold and the air stinks of salt and fish and brine. Sloane hates days that start out one way and then turn into something else. They make it harder to dress for work. She'd spent most of last night trying to decide what to wear to the office today. Around 3 a.m., she'd settled on the pink summer-weight St. John knit instead of the blue Tahari, because Mother loves the St. John, says it makes her look svelte. Too bad Mother won't get to see that she's wearing it for her big day. She tugs the skirt up around her waist, but it sags back and settles on her hip bones. This suit has never really fit, and the dark blue Tahari would have hidden the bloodstains better. The steady churning of the helicopters grows louder. Sloane flattens against the wall and peeks out into the night from behind one of Trevor's fancy Japanese shades. With the interior lights blazing, all she can see is her own reflection staring back. More than once, she has wanted to rip those silly shades from Trevor's windows, because who has an office on the 37th floor and covers up the view? Tonight, as flimsy as they are, she is glad to have them. Her stomach cramps hard and doubles her over. She slides to the floor, which is where Trevor lies face up, staring at the ceiling with the same look of surprise he died with. Sloane had never seen anyone die. Not before today. But she's been to plenty of funerals. She always assumed that the way you look in the casket is the way you looked when your life ended. But she's had time to ponder this, and it's now making sense to her. Once you're dead, you're dead. The light goes out and there is no time, no spark, no thought or impulse left to change the expression of absolute terror or disbelief or regret. Whatever you were feeling the moment the bullet entered your brain and blew half of it out the gigantic hole in the back of your skull. Her cell phone erupts in what had been until today her favorite Bach sonata. She taps the earpiece. You said I had 20 minutes.
You do. You do. I'm not trying to rush you. I'm just saying it doesn't mean we can't do it in less, or that we can't spend the 20 minutes talking.
I need that time. I need to think. I need... It burns where the earpiece's hook has irritated the layer of soft skin around the top of her ear. These things were never meant to be worn for 5 straight hours.
Talk to me, Sloane. What's going on up there?
She wishes she could see her hostage negotiator, but she doesn't know where he is. He can somehow see her, though. She's sure of it. Thinking about him watching over her makes her feel calmer, but he has the frustrating habit of asking the same questions over and over. I think you know, Officer Tarbox, that what's...
When do we switch back to Officer Tarbox?
What's going on in here, Jimmy, is the same thing that's been going on for the past 5 hours, and you promised me another 30 minutes 10 minutes ago.
I'll keep my word. You know I will. Have I let you down any? Have I lied to you even once? No. I'm just checking in to see how you are. I want to know that you're okay and that everything's still on track. If we're not talking, I don't know what's going on.
You just want to know how Beck is.
How is Beck?
She glances over at Cornelius Beckwith Nash III, graduate of Exeter, Yale School of Drama, and Harvard Business School, Olympic rowing team alternate and scratch golfer, lead manager on the biggest portfolio of the growth team at Crown & Shield Investment Management Company. Yet, as impressive as he is, she's not sure any of those experiences have prepared him for being lashed to a chair for 5 hours with a telephone cord and computer cables. He's also sitting in his own sewage, which can't be comfortable, but it was his own fault for coming into the office to investigate instead of running the other way. He'd soiled his pants almost the second he'd walked in. Between that and Trevor's brains on the wall, the room smells worse than any paddock she's ever been in. But you can put up with anything, Sloane has learned, if you have to. You just can't put up with it forever. Beck is fine.
Good. That's good. Can I talk to him?
No.
Why not?
Because she doesn't want to hear any more about little Max and littler Ian, and if she takes off Beck's gag, all he'll do is cry about how his sons need him and how they'll miss him. And she already knows everything she needs to know about little Max and littler Ian. They go to Fessenden, spend summers on Nantucket eating watermelon, and will one day grow up to be strapping blonde boys of privilege from the finest business schools who, given the chance, will pass her by, just as their father had. But she doesn't like it when Officer Jimmy is not happy with her. So she gets up from the floor, keeping her knees closed and turned gracefully to the side, heads over to Beck, takes off the earpiece, and holds it in front of him. Makes some kind of noise. The corners of Beck's mouth are split and caked with blood and dried spit where his $200 Xenia tie gag is pinching. She knows he can moan. He's been doing it on and off for hours. But right now he seems comatose, frozen with his eyes open. She shakes the earpiece. Do it! But he doesn't, and now she has to figure out how to make him. She hates the idea of touching him. The gun would be good for that. It's too heavy to carry around, so she keeps putting it down. Right now it's on Trevor's desk. But Beck is reading her mind. Before she even moves, he rolls out a few dry croaks, and she wonders if the back of his throat is somehow pasted to the front. See? She fits the earpiece back on her ear. He's fine. All right, says Jimmy, the officer. That's good. Now we need to start talking about how to resolve this thing. We're at this 5, going on 6 hours here, and you still haven't told me what you want. I was supposed to have 30 minutes to think about it, and you only gave me 10 minutes. You know we can't let this thing drag on forever. He says, forever. For all the things she likes about Jimmy Tarbox, the one thing that grates is his accent. Let's talk about how to get you and Beck out of there without anyone else getting hurt. Let's figure this out together. Sloane's stomach has settled, which means she can fall back into pacing the comfortable loop that runs between the conference table and the bookshelves, past the leather couch, the grandfather clock, and Beck, behind Trevor's desk, along his wall of photos, and back to the corner where the two walls of windows meet. Trevor is still wearing his raincoat and holding the handle of his soft leather briefcase in his right hand. Falling backwards, his left arm had hooked over one of his conference table chairs and pulled it down on top of him. His right leg is bent underneath him. He looks like a chalk outline. She steps over his head to get back on course. I can't come out. No one will understand what happened here. I understand. I know you didn't mean for all this to happen. You didn't get up this morning saying, today I'm going in to plug my boss. No. God, no. This was supposed to have been the best day of her life. After picking the St. John suit, she had fallen into bed and actually slept for 2 hours. Waking refreshed, she had decided to forego the planned cab ride and walk to work instead. She usually walked for the exercise, but today she had noticed things. People in soft pants and flip-flops out on the Comav Mall with their dogs, yawning and standing by with their baggies until there was a pile to clean up. The flowers in the public garden. Even the accordion-playing busker on the common sounded good to her. She'd seen him there often, sitting on the same low brick wall under a tree, squeezing out sad French ballads, collecting tips from the well-dressed army of posers and wannabes making its weary way to the financial district for another day in the mutual fund capital of the world. She had never given him a penny. She didn't believe in rewarding mediocrity. Also, he smelled. But today she had admired his work ethic. Today she had slipped a 20 into his collection cup, because everything was good, and everyone was kind, and even living in Boston wasn't so bad, because today, after 6 long years in this second-rate backwater town, she would be named managing director. She would cross the magic line, get her ticket punched, and one day soon get back home to New York, where they would surely have to take her seriously now. Best of all, she would never again have to explain to Mother why Beau, James, and Danny had made M.D. before her. Sure, they were 2, 4, and 7.5 years younger, but they were also young, strapping boys from the finest business schools, and the investment industry had no place for smart females, or any females, who didn't answer phones, fetch coffee, or give blowjobs to important clients. Sloane? What? Am I talking to myself here? Officer Jimmy is making his point, but with a light touch, and she wishes she had learned how to be that way. You were saying it makes a difference if I hadn't planned on shooting Trevor today. Exactly. That it wasn't premeditated. We can work with that, and we can do some things here so the situation doesn't get worse than it is. Uh-oh. Here it comes. She knows what he's about to say because he's said it 100 times already.
The biggest thing is you got to let Beck come out.
She breathes in deeply, pulling in the fetid and humid air that has filled the office ever since they turned off the air conditioners. As they always seem to, her grinding molars find the scar tissue inside her left cheek, and the taste in her mouth changes. She's bleeding.
Why is everyone so concerned about Beck? Beck is fine. Beck is more than fine. He got promoted today. Or was it yesterday? He gets to be an MD. And do you know how long it took him? A year. I've been here 6 years, and I've been up for MD the past four. Do you know who the biggest alpha generator around here is?
You?
For the past 2 years. What's an alpha? Alpha generation. It's just a way of showing who earns the most for the firm, who the best stock picker is, and it's me. Do you know what they told me last year? We can't promote you because you're too volatile. Everyone's afraid of you. And the year before that? We can't promote you because you're too quiet. No one ever knows what you're thinking.
Take it easy. I'm not trying to upset you. I'm trying to get you to think through this thing logically with me. People will be coming to work in a few hours. You and me, we have to be done and out of here by then.
She takes a turn too fast and nearly bangs into the corner of Trevor's desk. She uncrosses her arms and takes her fists from her armpits.
Do you have any idea what it's like to be strung along year after year? To get your hopes up and then get told, to have to sit and be told all the things that are wrong with you?
No, I don't know what it's like to be in your position, your work position or the one you're in now. But I do know what it's like to get passed over. I got passed over for this job 6 times.
He's saying all the right words. He's saying he understands because that's his job. But she hears it in his tone.
You stupid bitch, he's thinking. You had everything. The money, the Back Bay condo, the friggin' horse farm in Millbrook, the shopping trips to London. And you do this? This is what you do? You stupid, spoiled, rich little bitch.
She grabs the earpiece, holds it directly in front of her mouth.
I made $2.5 million last year. What did you make?
Hits the button to end the call. And just like that, Jimmy Tarbox is out of her head. But her head throbs. From the heat, maybe, or dehydration. She pushes back against it with the heels of her hands against her eyes. She holds her jacket open and fans it, trying to air out. All night, she's resisted taking it off. She never takes her jacket off in public. But it has to come off. It's too hard to breathe. What to do about Beck? She goes over and grabs the high back of his chair. It annoys her that he doesn't flinch anymore when she approaches. She turns him to face the wall. He can stare at Trevor's collection of golf photos. Instead of gliding off, the jacket's silk lining sticks to the damp insides of her elbows and she has to wrestle with it. Mother would be mortified. She settles it onto the hanger on the back of the door and stands with her arms wrapped around her. Spider arms, they used to call her. All the girls back at Monsignor Xavier Prep. She looks at Trevor's face. What had high school been like for him back in Manchester or Sheffield or wherever he was from? Probably no one ever called him names, but she didn't know. She didn't know much of anything about Trevor. Bony Sloaney, that was another one. She had hated high school with every fiber in her bony body, except for the stables. The horses and riding had saved her. These days, all that saves her is Rowan. She closes her eyes and tries to think of him. He can usually calm her down, but right now her head is too jammed. When she opens her eyes, there is Beck. She should kill him. Put the gun to the back of his head, pull the trigger, and put him down, all without ever having to look upon his classically handsome face again. She's already killed Trevor. Why not just do it now and let this end? Because she hadn't really thought it through with Trevor.
She'd caught him trying to sneak out of the building without talking to her. Not even sneaking, just walking out as if she hadn't been sitting in her office all day waiting for his call. As if she hadn't skipped her daily caramel latte to cut down on trips to the bathroom. As if she hadn't spent the long hours of the afternoon rocking back and forth at her desk, staring at the blinking cursor on her Bloomberg screen, and pleading with God not to let it happen again because she could feel it happening again. Falling and falling, waiting to hit the concrete, picking up speed with every second that ticked by with no call from Trevor. So she had prayed, asking God not to let her have anything else taken away. And then she'd heard the vacuum cleaner, and the vacuum cleaner only ran on her floor after 7 o'clock in the evening. She'd come out of her office to find the entire floor abandoned except for the summer intern, Hallie, huddled over the printer. She'd moved toward Trevor's office, slowing down as she went, not knowing if she was more afraid to find him there or gone. He was there all right. Impossible to miss. Blustery, blow-hard Trevor holding forth. The voice on the other side of the conversation hadn't been as loud, but she had recognized it. Trevor and Beck talking. Voices brimming with excitement and manly good cheer. The tone had been clear, but the words were covered by the sound of the approaching vacuum. She'd thought they might be talking golf. Her phone is singing again. She reaches for the earpiece and finds nothing but ear. Can't remember taking the thing off. She follows the buck and finds her cell on the conference table. Hello?
How you doing, kid?
Fine.
How's Beck?
Same.
I have to ask you to stop hanging up on me. The bosses are getting sick of this thing. You've got bosses. You know what I'm saying, right?
He's skipping over the fact that her boss is a corpse in a $6,000 Brioni suit and a Tag Heuer watch, and that she's the one who made him that way. He's acting as if she could surrender to him and then go home tonight, eat a banana for dinner, maybe walk over to Emac and Bolio's for a scoop of fat-free vanilla yogurt in a cup, make it last for an hour while she sits and watches the cool kids on Newbury Street smoking and laughing and texting. Then she could come in to work tomorrow, maybe wearing the dark blue tahari, and show up at the morning meeting as if nothing had happened. Of course, Beck would be the new MD on the growth team, or maybe they would just slot him into Trevor's job as CIO and promote some other strapping young boy from a fine business school to MD. Pick any of them, Justin, Peter, Shamir, she'd still be a senior portfolio manager. She would always be a senior portfolio manager, which was why she'd had no choice but to take the .22 out of her bag and shoot Trevor through the head.
I have to ask you this to make sure, Jimmy says. Don't get upset, but your father keeps calling from New York. Are you sure you don't want to talk to him?
She knows why Daddy is calling, and she knows why Mother isn't. Mother is lying perfectly still in some dark room with a damp cloth on her forehead and a few dozen milligrams of Percocet coursing through her veins. Daddy would be more worried than upset, worried about his cash flow.
Doesn't matter what they call you,
he always tells her, usually in front of her MD brothers,
as long as the bonuses keep rolling in.
Beau, James, and Danny were too smart or too selfish or both to keep investing in his hedge fund, which really meant tithing over some growing percentage of her annual bonus and calling it an investment so that Mother wouldn't be humiliated by another of Daddy's busted ventures. Eventually, Daddy had stopped asking her brothers for money.
They're married, he told her. They have families of their own to feed.
Sloane's legs feel like dead weights, so heavy. She walks to the couch and crashes down. I don't want to talk to him, and if you make me, I swear I will hang up and you will never hear from me again.
I can't make you do anything, remember? You're in charge. We're doing things your way.
Then stop asking.
Tell him to stop calling. Consider it done. Is there anyone you want to talk to? Who's this Rowan?
She smiles, envisioning Officer Jimmy thumbing quickly through a stack of background information on her that someone has dumped in his lap.
My horse.
Your horse?
There is shuffling and mumbling. Okay, I see it here now. Holy smokes, he's a beauty. Is he at your horse farm?
More shuffling.
Where is this Millbrook, anyway?
New York.
New York is a big state, and I'm sitting here without my Google.
That's a lie. He's probably sitting there with every possible source of data at his disposal. But she doesn't mind playing along with Officer Jimmy. It's in the eastern part of the state, close to the Connecticut border.
How long's it take you to get out there?
3.5 hours.
You just go 90 west?
To Route 22.
Yeah, I have no idea where that is.
If you keep going on 22, you get to Poughkeepsie.
If you say so. How often do you get out there?
Every weekend.
Wow. You must really like the place.
There isn't a word strong enough to describe how she feels out there. Millbrook is her escape. She makes the drive every Friday after work, rain or shine, happy or sad. She stays through Sunday night and drives straight to work on Monday. There is space out there. There is grass and air that smells nice. In the winter, there is clean snow that stretches on forever. And Rowan. She closes her eyes and conjures him. She smells his barn and feels him moving under her hands as she curries his withers. The grooms always put him on the cross ties to clean him, but not Sloane. She scratches all his favorite places and smiles when he curls his neck around to give her a playful nudge every time she finds another with the hard bristles. Then she rides him and feels his calm and coiled anticipation as he gathers himself for a jump. Then the explosion, the thrust high into the air, and that feeling of flying. Just Rowan and her, her face so close that his mane brushes her cheek. She pushes at the tears with the back of her hand and gets to her feet.
I'm turning off the lights. It's too hot in here. I'm also putting up one of the blinds, just so you know. Just so you know, I don't control the snipers. I'm not the one in charge of the scene.
I don't even have the gun. It's on Trevor's standing desk. She looks around for her earpiece so she can have both hands free. Hopes the battery hasn't run down.
What the hell is a standing desk?
All the CIOs have them. It's a power thing.
What's a CIO?
Chief Investment Officer. She finds the earpiece on the floor near Beck's chair and switches the call over. But Trevor didn't want one like everyone else, so he... Actually, he had his assistant, Nicole, do all the research, and she found this mahogany antique that was used by Charles Dickens. It cost the firm over $100,000 to have it restored and shipped from London.
$100,000? Jeez, that would have covered both my kids' college tuition.
The light switch is by the door. This time, as she passes Trevor, she reaches down and tips the chair off of him, setting it back on its feet. She flips the lights off and feels instantly better, cooler. She rolls up one of the fancy shades and then, what the hell, does them all. She opens all the windows of the corner office to the nighttime view. It is magnificent, even at 2 o'clock in the morning. She feels as if she's floating out over the harbor, just another of the lights moving across the water. They must be ships, those lights, and she wonders what life would be like living on a moving vessel. Logan has airport lights, red ones, green ones, bright beacons, flashing fast and slow. The runway lights look like jeweled bracelets laid out on a black velvet pillow. The glass window feels cool, so she presses her cheek against it, the side without the earpiece. Will the snipers shoot me?
Why would they shoot you while we're still talking? and so long as you're leaving Beck alone. How is Beck? Does he need any water?
Do you care what happens to me?
I've spent all night talking to you. What do you think?
I think you care about what happens to Beck.
I do, and I care about what happens to you. That's no bullshit. I want you to walk out of there.
Trevor's body is hard to see in the dark, but she knows it's there.
Why would you care? Why would anyone care? I'm a murderer.
She's been trying all night to feel the weight of that word and how to wear it. Mostly she feels how Mother will wear it.
Listen, kid, I deal with all kinds in this job. I can tell the wackos, and I can tell the ones that just got pushed too far. You get pushed around until you can't do it anymore, and then something happens. It's just a wrong place, wrong time, bad chain of events kind of a deal. And if one thing had gone different yesterday, maybe none of this happens. Am I right?
The sky is another sight to behold. The moon lights the clouds from behind, making them seem transparent and solid at the same time as they rush through space. What are the names of the islands, Jimmy?
What islands?
Isn't there something out there called the Harbor Islands? She's seen them 1,000 times from Trevor's office.
Sure, but there's something like 40 of them out there. You never went to any of them?
I never did. Tell me some of the names.
Long Island, Sheep Island. There's a little one called Grape. I went swimming once with my brothers. It's spectacle. It used to have great beaches, but then the city used it for dumping all the big dig dirt, so I don't know what it's like now. Deer Island is where they have the shit plant.
Excuse me?
Sewage plant. One of the Brewsters has the oldest lighthouse ever. George's Island has a Civil War fort. I went to both of those on school field trips when I was a kid. There's a Sarah's Island. I always remember it because that was my ma's name.
Where are you from?
Haverhill.
Where are you right now?
I can't tell you that.
She scans the building at State Street and Congress, the only one tall enough for him to be looking down at her. But it's a huge black mirrored tower that reveals nothing. Can I see you?
I'll spend all the time in the world with you, but you gotta let Beck come out of there. And you need to come out, too. What you have to keep in mind is that you're still young, and you deserve to come out of there in one piece. You need to give yourself that chance.
Another requirement. Another trade-off. Another contingent offer. She slides down the window and sits with her back to the north, looking out over the water. Was it supposed to rain today, Jimmy?
If it was supposed to, it never did.
It just struck me as so odd that he was wearing a raincoat, because I hadn't heard anything about rain today, and the whole time we were having our meeting, he never took it off.
Trevor?
I was standing outside his office, listening to him talking to Beck, and then Beck came out and I wanted to go in. I assumed it was my turn, that he was just running late with his meetings. I didn't want to look too eager, so I went to my office and packed my things and came back.
Make it look all casual, huh? Like you had just leaving and stopped by?
I was standing there, trying to get up the courage to walk in. Then he walked out and nearly ran me over. He wasn't happy to see me, I could tell, but he wouldn't show it. You know what he said? Brilliant! As if it was a stroke of grand good luck that I was standing right there. Of course I'm still here, you bastard. You told me yesterday not to leave today without seeing you because you would have good news for me, which is why I spent the entire day locked in my office, afraid to go to the bathroom because I was waiting for you to call me, you pompous, self-centered ass.
You said that to him?
Officer Jimmy's voice holds a hint of respect. And for a moment, Sloane feels as if they really are buddies in a foxhole. But she hadn't actually said any of those things to Trevor. We came into the office, and he stood behind his desk.
His $100,000 standing desk?
I've never seen him use that. No, he stood behind his sitting desk, but he didn't sit, and I could tell he didn't want me to sit, but I did anyway. Then he opened his desk drawer and, without looking, reached in and took out an envelope, and I tried as hard as I could to come up with a good reason why my bonus check was the only one left in the drawer, and why it was after 7 o'clock, and the only reason he was talking to me at all was because I'd caught him trying to slip out, and why, if it was good news, he hadn't already given it to me.
I hear you.
When he pushed the envelope across the desk, he gave me one of his looks, where he cocks up an eyebrow. I think you'll be very pleased with that. She tries to capture not just his accent, but his condescending tone. I just sat there, with this pain in my stomach, and a horrible sensation running up and down my back, and I really thought I was just going to die, sitting right there waiting for him to tell me.
You sound like you were in shock.
But he just stood there, still in his raincoat, doing one of those things where you glance at your watch without wanting someone to see that you're doing it.
Prick.
Then he said, "Aren't you going to open it?" And I said, "I didn't get it, did I? I didn't get MD. He looked at me, and I could see what he was thinking right on his face. "You bitch, you ungrateful little cunt." I know that's what he was thinking, because I've heard him say that word before, and he wasn't even trying to hide it. How much he hated me. How much he loathed me for not letting him go home or to the cigar bar or wherever. That's when I knew.
What did you know?
That I was never going to get MD. Sloane pushes herself up from the floor, but falls back against the window. Her skirt comes all the way up her thighs as she tries to find her balance. No food for almost 2 days. No water since early afternoon. The heat. It's all starting to catch up with her, and she'll pass out soon. She finally makes it to her feet. No matter how good I was, no matter how much money I made for them, they were going to keep telling me I was this close, and to hang in there, and that next year would be my year, and then next year would come around and they'd promote someone like Beck because they like Beck and they can talk about golf with him. One by one, she pulls the shades down.
What are you doing up there, Sloane? What's going on now?
Maybe she's memorized this room. Because how else can she walk across the office through the dark without bumping into things? She finds the gun on the standing desk.
Talk to me, kid. I need to hear you.
Trevor told me he had this wired. He told me there was no way I wasn't getting it, that this was my year. When I reminded him of this, he said, "Who can fathom what goes on behind those closed doors? Certainly I can't. One answer goes in and a different answer comes out. It's damn confounding, damn confounding. But you can't take it personally."
He's still a prick. But what are you doing?
That's when I started to think about it. I wanted to kill him. I wanted to grab him by his tie and squeeze until his head popped off, which wasn't a real option. But I did have the gun.
Do you have the gun now?
You know how you just said that if one thing had gone differently yesterday, maybe none of this would have happened?
Yes.
It was Sunday. The thing that happened. I had to use the gun on Sunday in Millbrook. It was still in my travel bag. I forgot to take it out, so there it was. Officer Jimmy says nothing for a few seconds.
You didn't hurt anybody out in Millbrook, did you?
The tears come again. She tries to hold them back. She's never cried in front of anyone. But it's no use.
and then she's wailing into Officer Jimmy's ear. The only one who got hurt out there was me.
She's standing behind Beck now, looking over his shoulder at Trevor's framed photos on the wall. There's a light from somewhere because she can see it clearly, the one he was most proud of, Trevor with Nick Price. The first time she'd ever heard of Nick Price was the first time she'd been in Trevor's office, the day of her first interview. The pro golfer, he'd explained, patiently filling in the unfortunate gaps in her knowledge. Nicest guy you'd ever want to meet, is what he'd said. Later she'd learned that it was what he said to everyone who came into his office. Price had written in bold black strokes across his own red shirt, "To Trevor, keep your head down, my friend. All the best, Nick." Sloane couldn't hear anything. Too much noise outside. But she could see Beck struggling. He couldn't see her, but he must have sensed her standing behind him with the gun. "He won the British Open," Sloane says, repeating to Jimmy what Trevor had said to her at just the wrong moment, in just the wrong tone. If he had just taken off his raincoat.
Who did?
I was sitting in my chair, completely devastated. I couldn't stand to look at Trevor, so I looked past him, and I must have been staring at Nick Price, and it occurred to me that Beck had gotten MD. Her hands shook so much, she had a hard time releasing the safety. I didn't get MD. Beck did. That's what they were talking about. That's what they were laughing about. I'm hearing you, Sloane, but you have to slow things down. Do me a favor and take a breath, please. I've decided what I want, Jimmy. Tell me. I want you to mix my ashes with Rowan's. Officer Jimmy is breathing harder now. She pictures him standing, maybe doing some pacing of his own.
Don't start talking like that. No one's going to be ashes at the end of this, because then I'm going to look bad, and neither one of us wants that.
He tries for one of his light chuckles, but it's not like before.
Besides, you don't want anything happening to that beautiful horse of yours.
He's dead. For the first time in their conversation, Officer Jimmy has nothing to say. Then, finally,
what happened?
He spooked. He ran into a car, and I had... She tries for a breath, but it catches in her chest. I called the vet, but it took too long, and he was so broken and suffering too much, and I couldn't watch him like that, so I had to... Her head pounds with the effort to get each word out, but she's determined. No more requirements, no more contingencies. I put him down. He was never going to be all right again. I had to put him down. This time, when she takes a breath, the air goes deep, and she feels calm. Rowan could always calm her down. His ashes are in the box on the table in my condo.
Okay, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking there's nothing left for you, right? You're thinking there's no way out of this, but it's not true.
Jimmy's voice fades away. When did this gun get so heavy? She can barely lift it. Do one other thing, Officer Jimmy. She presses the barrel against her forehead, puts both thumbs on the trigger. Please tell Trevor's family that I'm sorry. She closes her eyes and thinks about Rowan.
Go! 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 Go!
The door explodes behind her. Her hands stop shaking. She holds the gun steady and pulls the trigger.
Animal Rescue, written by Dennis Lehane and narrated by Jason Culp. Dorchester.
Bob found the dog in the trash. It was just after Thanksgiving. The neighborhood gone quiet, hungover. After bartending at Cousin Marv's, Bob sometimes walked the streets. He was big and lumpy, and hair had been growing in unlikely places all over his body since his teens. In his 20s, he'd fought against the hair, carrying small clippers in his coat pocket and shaving twice a day. He'd also fought the weight, but during all those years of fighting, no girl who wasn't being paid for it ever showed any interest in him. After a time, he gave up the fight. He lived alone in the house he grew up in, and when it seemed likely to swallow him with its smells and memories and dark couches, the attempts he'd made to escape it, through church socials, lodge picnics, and one horrific mixer thrown by a dating service, had only opened the wound further, left him patching it back up for weeks, cursing himself for hoping. So he took these walks of his, and if he was lucky, sometimes he forgot people lived any other way. That night, he paused on the sidewalk, feeling the ink sky above him and the cold in his fingers, and he closed his eyes against the evening. He was used to it. He was used to it. It was okay. You could make a friend of it, as long as you didn't fight it. With his eyes closed, he heard it, a worn-out keening, accompanied by distant scratching and a sharper metallic rattling. He opened his eyes. 15 feet down the sidewalk, a large metal barrel with a heavy lid shook slightly under the yellow glare of the streetlight, its bottom scraping the sidewalk. He stood over it and heard that keening again, the sound of a creature that was one breath away from deciding it was too hard to take the next, and he pulled off the lid. He had to remove some things to get to it, a toaster and 5 thick yellow pages, the oldest dating back to 2000. The dog, either a very small one or else a puppy, was down at the bottom, and it scrunched its head into its midsection when the light hit it. It exhaled a soft chug of a whimper and tightened its body even more, its eyes closed to slits. A scrawny thing. Bob could see its ribs. He could see a big crust of dried blood by its ear. No collar. It was brown with a white snout and paws that seemed far too big for its body. It let out a sharper whimper when Bob reached down, sank his fingers into the nape of its neck, and lifted it out of its own excrement. Bob didn't know dogs too well, but there was no mistaking this one for anything but a boxer, and definitely a puppy, the wide brown eyes opening and looking into his as he held it up before him. Somewhere, he was sure, two people made love, a man and a woman, entwined. Behind one of those shades, oranged with light, that looked down on the street, Bob could feel them in there, naked and blessed. And he stood out here in the cold with a near-dead dog staring back at him. The icy sidewalk glinted like new marble, and the wind was dark and gray as slush.
"What do you got there?"
Bob turned, looked up and down the sidewalk.
"I'm up here, and you're in my trash."
She stood on the front porch of the 3-decker nearest him. She turned the porch light on and stood there shivering, her feet bare. She reached into the pocket of her hoodie and came back with a pack of cigarettes. She watched him as she got one going.
"I found a dog."
Bob held it up.
"A what?" "A dog. A puppy. A boxer, I think."
She coughed out some smoke.
"Who puts a dog in a barrel?"
"Right," he said. "It's bleeding." He took a step toward her stairs, and she backed up.
"Who do you know that I would know?"
A city girl, not about to just drop her guard around a stranger.
"I don't know," Bob said. "How about Francie Hedges?"
She shook her head.
"You know the Sullivans?"
That wouldn't narrow it down. Not around here. You shook a tree, a Sullivan fell out, followed by a 6-pack, most times.
"I know a bunch."
This was going nowhere, the puppy looking at him, shaking worse than the girl.
"Hey," she said, You live in this parish?
Next one over. St. Teresa's.
Go to church?
Most Sundays.
So you know Father Pete?
Pete Regan, he said. Sure.
She produced a cell phone.
What's your name?
Bob, he said. Bob Saganowski.
Bob waited as she stepped back from the light, phone to one ear, finger pressed into the other. He stared at the puppy. The puppy stared back like, how did I get here? Bob touched its nose with his index finger. The puppy blinked its huge eyes. For a moment, Bob couldn't recall his sins.
Nadia,
the girl said, and stepped back into the light.
Bring him up here, Bob. Pete says hi.
They washed it in Nadia's sink, dried it off, and brought it to her kitchen table. Nadia was small. A bumpy red rope of a scar ran across the base of her throat, like the smile of a drunk circus clown. She had a tiny moon of a face, savaged by pockmarks, and small, heart-pendant eyes. Shoulders that didn't cut so much as dissolve at the arms. Elbows like flattened beer cans. A yellow bob of hair curled on either side of her face.
It's not a boxer.
Her eyes glanced off Bob's face before dropping the puppy back onto her kitchen table.
It's an American Staffordshire Terrier.
Bob knew he was supposed to understand something in her tone, but he didn't know what that thing was, so he remained silent. She glanced back up at him after the quiet lasted too long.
A pit bull.
That's a pit bull?
She nodded and swabbed the puppy's head wound again. Someone had pummeled it, she told Bob. Probably knocked it unconscious, assumed it was dead, and dumped it.
Why? Bob said.
She looked at him, her round eyes getting rounder, wider.
Just because?
She shrugged, went back to examining the dog.
I worked at Animal Rescue once. You know the place on Shawmut? As a vet tech. Before I decided it wasn't my thing. They're so hard, this breed.
What?
To adopt out, she said. It's very hard to find them a home.
I don't know about dogs. I never had a dog. I live alone. I was just walking by the barrel.
Bob found himself beset by a desperate need to explain himself, explain his life.
I'm just not...
He could hear the wind outside, black and rattling. Rain or bits of hail spit against the windows. Nadia lifted the puppy's back left paw. The other three paws were brown, but this one was white with peach spots. Then she dropped the paw, as if it were contagious. She went back to the head wound, took a closer look at the right ear, a piece missing from the tip that Bob hadn't noticed until now.
Well, she said, he'll live. You're gonna need a crate and food and all sorts of stuff.
No, Bob said. You don't understand.
She cocked her head, gave him a look that said she understood perfectly.
I can't. I just found him. I was going to give him back.
To whoever beat him? Left him for dead?
No. Like the authorities.
That would be animal rescue, she said. After they give the owner 7 days to reclaim him, they'll...
The guy who beat him? He gets a second chance?
She gave him a half frown and a nod.
If he doesn't take it.
She lifted the puppy's ear, peered in.
Chances are this little fellow be put up for adoption, but it's hard to find them a home. Pit bulls. More often than not,
she looked at Bob.
More often than not, they're put down.
Bob felt a wave of sadness roll out from her that immediately shamed him. He didn't know how, but he'd caused pain. He'd put some out into the world. He'd let this girl down.
He started. It's just...
She glanced up at him.
I'm sorry.
Bob looked at the puppy. Its eyes were droopy from a long day in the barrel, and whoever gave it that wound. It had stopped shivering, though.
You can take it, Bob said. You used to work there, like you said. You...
She shook her head.
My father lives with me. He gets home Sunday night from Foxwoods. He finds a dog in his house,